The Far Side, Master Ace, Sage Francis, Necro, Blue in Exile, Mad Lion, Project Bloat All-Star Cypher, Grouch and Eli, The Shapeshifters, Destruct, Reverie, DJ Luman, DJ Lala, and a lot more. Hosted by Immortal Technique. That's Rhymefest LA, taking place Saturday, April 15th. For more information, visit rhymefestla.com or kpfk.org.
Welcome to Gray Zone Radio. I'm your host and the editor of thegrayzone.com, Max Blumenthal. Today, I want to feature an excerpt of a conversation I just held with one of my favorite podcasts. It's called Rare Candy, and it's hosted by Glenn Rockne and Crypto Psy. They cover each week issues ranging from alternative health to science to international politics. And we held a wide-ranging, spontaneous conversation covering everything from the protests taking place from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and Israel right now against Benjamin Netanyahu's judicial reforms, to the competing evils of America's billionaire class, to the state of play in the Ukraine proxy war, and the bombing of the Nord Stream pipelines, which is still said to be unsolved, even though it's pretty clear who's behind it. So take a listen.
Yeah. And so what? So you brought up Israel. You were talking about there's some protests going on there. Now I'm completely out of the loop on that. What is the deal with the protests?
Yeah. For the prime minister's residence was raided two nights ago they pulled like a January 6th on him. And what? Yeah, like an entire crowd of protesters stormed the prime minister's residence two nights ago. The streets are filled in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem with hundreds of thousands of people, let's say at least tens of thousands of people. Damn. They're all Jewish. They're all waving Israeli flags, but they're protesting the most right-wing government in Israel's history. Hmm. And I wrote two books about Israel-Palestine. One kind of predicted everything that was happening now, and it was about how Netanyahu had come in, and this was a transitional point in Israeli history, that Israel would, from that point on, be a right-wing country that would have no tolerance for any peace process or ending the occupation, that it saw no difference between the settlements in the West Bank and where the Jewish Israeli population lives in so-called Israel proper, and that the religious nationalist elements would eventually take over, because the occupation had been going on so long, and every Israeli male, female at age 18 has to be serving in the army and gets indoctrinated at an early age to participate in army culture. So the whole society is basically mobilized for this permanent occupation. And what kind of politics is that going to produce? It's going to produce a militaristic, nationalistic politics where more and more of the population becomes extremely religious, which means like the base of Israel's support, which are liberal Jews in the US, are going to be pretty alienated. So what we're seeing now is, I wouldn't call it a culmination, but it's like acceleration of the process that I described in my book, where Netanyahu has come in with a coalition in order for him to, it's a parliamentary system. So you have to get like this guy who got like four seats and this guy got three seats and this lady got 12 seats and this weird party gets eight seats. So like the weird party in his coalition, there are several of them. One is, and weird by, liberal democratic standards, it's an ultra-Orthodox party. They don't want to serve in the military. They don't really want to, the men don't really work. They study Torah all day. And they get tons of tax dollars. Why? Because they need Jewish bodies there to outnumber the Palestinians, and they make tons of babies. They shoot babies out like t-shirt guns. Wow. And so that helps them with the demographic situation. So the ultra-Orthodox have a lot of power in Israel, but a whole part of the society hates them. The part of the society that's secular, serves in the military, resents them. Then you have these fanatical settler parties. This one party is called Jewish Power. It's like basically the equivalent of white power. I've, you know, interacted with them. I filmed them. If you go on YouTube, if you're listening to this, watch a video I made with an Israeli journalist named David Sheen called Israel's New Racism. And we basically followed a group from this party as they rioted. They carried out a pogrom against a community of African migrants in Tel Aviv and just were like spitting on pregnant African women and, you know, carrying out like, it was like something out of Nazi Germany in the 30s. And we were just standing there filming it. And then in the end, they attack us. It's all there. It's got millions of views. I think it has like 5 million, 8 million views. Actually, I had an African neighbor in Jersey City where I was living when I produced that. And she just came up and she's like, "You made that video. Everybody in Africa is watching it." So this party is like, it's like, if you think about how much Israel puts into propaganda, into convincing the world that it's this great democracy, then you have this party of Jewish Nazis in the coalition because Netanyahu, it was the only way Netanyahu could come back into power, is to get those 4 seats. And they control one of the major security ministries, which means they have control over the national police. And the other person in the party who's advocated, Bezalel Smotrich, he's advocated separating maternity wards between Jewish and non-Jewish in hospitals. He is the finance minister. So he can control, he's just sending money to the settlements and to his fanatical buddies. So then Netanyahu himself, he's the longest serving prime minister in forever, the longest serving prime minister. And he has all these corruption scandals, so many corruption scandals I can't even count. And there's just hilarious audio tapes of his sons who are like the ultimate fail sons, bragging about how like they can get some oligarch on the line who will pay for them to like tip strippers all night because their dad cut a gas deal with them. It's just like, Netanyahu is accused of siphoning off money from like German Holocaust reparations. And so what he wants to do is he's doing this legal reform that the settlers all support, and they're going to weaken the power of the Supreme Court. And so the liberal enlightened part of Israeli society that is the minority is basically waging kind of a color revolution and trying to overthrow Netanyahu by refusing to participate. They've done a general strike for the first time in like 30 years. The military reservists, especially in the Air Force, because that's where the, like, you would call them the Ashkenazi elite. Like, I'm an Ashkenazi Jew because I'm white and I'm from Europe, right. European descent. So they're the elite of Israeli society. They are refusing to participate in the military now over this. And then at the heart of it is the Supreme Court, which is the considered sort of the protector of liberal Israeli society. And it's the part that like American liberal Jews who still believe in Israel really revere. Like Elena Kagan, the Supreme Court Justice, her mentor was the Israeli former Chief Justice Aharon Barak, who ushered in these kind of liberal laws that are non-binding called the basic laws that Netanyahu wants to roll back. So the point, there are a few points here. The first point is this is like liberal Israeli society's last stand. The second point is liberal Israeli society is deeply connected to the Democratic Party and to liberal Jewish institutions in the US, which are in many ways sponsoring or supporting these protests. And number three, liberal Israeli society is deeply racist and responsible for the occupation and has no interest in ending, doing anything to address the horror that Palestinians are living through. And Palestinians are put on the sidelines. This isn't about, you know, helping Palestinians end the occupation. This isn't about human rights for them. This is about an internal fight among a culture war inside Israel. And the position I take is that what Netanyahu is doing is showing the real face of Israel that Palestinians have always understood and seen ever since 1948 and before, when they were removed from their land at gunpoint and laws were ushered in under supposedly socialist governments in Israel. It was socialism for Jews only, that would literally illegalize Palestinians from returning to their own homes and place the homes in the hands of the government. And then the government would give out those homes to Jews, including Jews from the displaced persons camps in Europe who had lived through the Holocaust. There are stories of Jews coming from those camps, coming to Palestinian homes and just taking the silverware or the dishes that the Palestinians had left as their own because they came with nothing. And that's the liberal Israel. The liberal Israel is the pilots who are refusing to participate in the military because of Netanyahu's judicial reforms, going and bombing entire multifamily homes in the Gaza Strip with precision-guided missiles, following orders to exterminate entire families because the father belongs to the wrong political faction. He belongs to Hamas. That's liberal Israel. So I mean, the sympathy I have for them is none. And what they're trying to do is get back to a time when Israel could continue slaughtering Palestinians, displacing them and occupying them, and tell the world that it's a real democracy. And Netanyahu's base is like, we can't be a democracy. We're for Jews. We're for Jewish power. And that's right. The way politics across the West is going. I mean, if you look at, you know, European politics, people are getting more and more nationalistic and they're getting fed up with all of these liberal institutions. So that's the way I see those protests.
So do you think, so in terms of like nationalism, I'd like to, because it does seem like nationalism now, there are people that kind of retreat or kind of not, when you look at what our society is, like a very global society, like we have a global economy, you know, with COVID happening, there was a lot of global talk with all that, without getting too far into that. I guess what I mean is, do you almost, can you understand why some people are like, well, nationalism, that makes more sense. You know what I mean? Why people maybe reactively might understand like, hey, I don't like this whole like global free trade thing that ruins my economy. You know what I mean? That the bad trade deals from the Clinton administration and stuff. Can you maybe sympathize why some people might be not racially nationalistic, but almost just territorially at least?
Well, there are different kinds of nationalism. It depends on what kind of country you have. Like the national narrative of the U.S. is not, at least since the 1964 Civil Rights Act, but also just the way that most Americans, including many people who voted for Trump, understand it, is not that it is, you know, a country exclusively for white Christian people. Although I think many people who support Trump might feel that way or be upset that it's changing, but there are different kinds of nationalism. And there's a concept of sovereignty that is at the heart of, for example, Latin American socialism, Cuban socialism, Venezuelan socialism. It's all about sovereignty, the right to defend your own, to control your, or, you know, African revolutionary leaders like Patrice Lumumba, the right to control your own resources, profit from them and provide the profits to your people, your constituents. That's a form of nationalism. Palestinian nationalism. They've been denied the ability to have a nation. So they are citizens of nowhere, which means they have no formal rights. And so Palestinian nationalism is a constant fight. In many ways, it's an armed guerrilla fight to force Israel to recede from their territory so they can have land in order to have a nation. And Palestinian nationalism is the most demonized form of nationalism in the world. I think if many America firsters in the U.S. would understand who Palestinians are, that they are an agricultural farm-based people who have been fighting this Red Dawn style fight against an occupying, invading force for their land, that they would, and that they are their tradition, they're a traditional culture. They're also fighting for their traditional culture, that they would identify with them more. Israeli nationalism is entirely based around the concept that Jews comprise a nation, that a religion comprises a nation, and that the nation must be representative exclusively of members of that religion. And so everybody else who exists within the realm of that nation cannot have formal rights, or their rights are severely weakened, like the Palestinian citizens of Israel. So, I mean, that's not a form of nationalism I can get behind. So the question is, what is the national narrative? But what you're talking about also is sovereignty. And yeah, more and more people are seeing, for example, I'm very sympathetic to the migrants who go to Europe because they have nowhere else to go. But I also have to feel sorry for Europeans who are having their pensions reduced and taken away. And all of a sudden, while their governments are giving weapons to jihadists in Syria and creating a humanitarian catastrophe, people from that country come and then they have to, you know, pay for these migrant centers. And like, I mean, Germany welcomed a million migrants while the German workers saw their quality of life declining rapidly. And so the answer there is stop bombing those countries, stop flooding them with weapons, or in our case, stop passing these free trade deals and giving these jobs away. I mean, the anti-immigrant sentiment that you can feel in so many you know, border communities across the U.S. I spent a ton of time on the border on both sides. It coincided directly with NAFTA. And like what I saw in the first article I ever did, actually, when I was getting into journalism, I went to Ciudad Juarez on the Mexican side of the El Paso border, on the other side of El Paso. El Paso was one of the safest cities in America at the time I went there. It was like 2002 when I went. And Juarez was experiencing a wave of serial killings of women. And I went with families who were looking for their daughters outside town. Just they would go every weekend to look for their daughters' bodies. And I went to a pit, which had been a mass grave that nine girls had just been found in. And no one knew who was killing them or what was killing them. But who were they? They were all young women who had come alone to this giant city to work in the maquiladoras, or the sweatshops being set up by U.S. corporations that moved across the border overnight. And El Paso was actually deteriorating because it lost its Levi's plant, which was like where the blue collar population of El Paso, like you could always get a job at this massive Levi's plant and have like a stable life. And that just went away overnight. It went to the other side of the border, and then horror erupted. So of course I identify with that. And like the term globalist, it is associated with anti-Semitism, but what do we call Bill Gates?
Here's
the guy who simultaneously like,
I got some names I could call him, but I don't think we want to air him, you know.
But he's not like, you know, a lot of people I'm around, they're anti-imperialist, so they have this understanding of imperialism as the highest stage of capitalism, and it represents the West. And so you have like imperialist billionaires like George Soros, who are actually trying to carry out regime change operations in former socialist countries, open up their economies, and then come in and pillage. I mean, that's like kind of a stereotype, and he works with the CIA to do so. But then you got Bill Gates. Bill Gates, you know, he's heavily involved in U.S. politics. He's the largest landowner in America. He's donated $350 million to U.S. media. He's highly influential here, but he's also friends with Xi Jinping in China. Right. He's close to the Chinese government. He's not hostile to them. So that would, an imperialist like George Soros wants to topple the Chinese government. Soros said that. So what is Bill Gates? Uh-huh. What do we call him? I mean, I think that the term globalist would apply to him pretty well. He sees no national borders, is loyal to no country, and only wants power for, he essentially wants world control for himself and his clique.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because we talk about this a lot on the podcast with billionaires, where like globalists is the term that kind of right wingers are using now and have used in the past, whereas imperialism, that's like the leftist term. Yeah. And, you know, like the leftists are really scared of saying anything bad about Soros or even Bill Gates because that you're a chud if you do that, right?
Right winger,
But Mark Cuban, fair game. Like critique him, you know, like all Elon, Richard Branson, Elon. Yeah, exactly. So it's funny. It's all the same thing. Yeah, it's interesting. Where are you saying, Glenn?
No, I just mean in a sense, like, yeah, it's people are afraid. Just going off what you said, people are afraid to just call evil evil. And, you know, to me, I just call Bill Gates evil. Like I get it. You want to attach kind of like a, you know, a term, like a big geopolitical term to him, because it is helpful to do that when you get into a lot of high level conversations. But I look at what he does and it's just like, man, it's evil stuff. Why does he need all that farmland? You see what he's doing with it. What, for the last 3 years, I mean, the guy was basically on the right side of the last 3 years, which many Americans are now finally waking up to, at least, though it's not the number I want it to be, as kind of like a reset, right? I mean, I don't want to, that term's been beaten to a pulp. So it's like, what else do you call Bill Gates, right? It's that's what I say. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there isn't much left opposition to Bill Gates. It isn't like as ferocious as it should be. I mean, here's someone who he clearly is buying up all the land so he can control the means of production and food supply. Mm-hmm. And one man with that level of control through a series of companies should be the target, like the ultimate target of the socialist left. But you don't hear that much about him. And then George Soros, you're always told you're an anti-Semite if you criticize George Soros. With the anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. If you talk about things that the Open Society foundations actually fund, okay, why are we equating George Soros with Judaism? If we do that, we are denigrating Judaism and Jews, because, I mean, he's not as bad as Sheldon Adelson, but he's kind of an anti-Semitic stereotype. And so we should be, you know, criticizing him as someone who is, you know, not representative of Jews, but like everyone, every single one of his defenders calls you an anti-Semite if you say anything about him writing in the New York Review of Books, for example, which he funds and helps and influences, that the U.S. should topple the Syrian government by force. Like, I can't if I criticize that, I'm an anti-Semite.
Yeah.
And it's just, Soros keeps coming up in our work at the Gray Zone because he funds everything we're exposing alongside the CIA. It's like the classic CIA modus operandi where they cannot directly fund civil society organizations that are trying to topple a government that the U.S. wants removed. So they go to their billionaire proxies like Soros, who is identified in a 1991 Washington Post article by David Ignatius as a overt operator on behalf of the CIA. He wrote that Soros and the National Endowment for Democracy are doing what the CIA used to do in secret, overtly. And so it's right there in the Washington Post. And so I'm not allowed to criticize that. But Elon, I mean, that's just so...
Yeah,
it's like we can only criticize the like more buffoonish billionaires.
To be honest, I tend to, and this is not a defense of Elon Musk, because I've seen the early, being a Silicon Valley, you know, resident and stuff, I've seen the, you know, the rise of Elon Musk, and I've never been a fan. However, it's just like the eccentric, you know, making outlandish statement billionaire in public, to me, is more of a natural, I have a bunch of money, rather type of thing, rather than like, actually, you'll never see me, you know, George Soros. Actually, my son, I think it's Alex or something, his son, will have his Instagram where he's like, just watching the ducks with my dad out on the lake, you know, like that's like, that. Just like he has those, like, you know, things. It's all this like secret, like, you know, you'll never know who this guy is. You'll never know that. Like, even Bill Gates shows his face. You know, he's weird and awkward and annoying, but like he shows his face. He'll go on 60 Minutes. He'll go on these and that. Like Soros, you never see this guy. So I think the mystery behind these big money, Sheldon Adelson, all these guys, these big money guys, that's the scary thing, is when you don't see them making the weird outlandish thing. Right. Like that, that's when things start to get weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Soros, he's just not a very appealing character. He's also very old, but he has like a thick Hungarian accent, and he just comes off like a stereotype. It's just, so he's probably been advised not to talk. Sheldon Adelson, I mean, what is he? He's someone who said he was sorry that he served in the U.S. military or the U.S. Army when he was younger. He wished he had served in the Israeli army. His entire mission is to guide U.S. policy in support of Israel's right wing and have a war with Iran. He said publicly that the U.S. should drop a nuclear weapon on Iran. And yet he's operating in the inner sanctum of American politics. That, you know, you would think there would have been more alarm about that. But instead, we hear about these random guys who have some Russian heritage. Actually, most of them are dual Israeli citizens who are forcing or who are influencing Trump to do Russia's bidding. Like all we heard about during Russiagate were these random guys I'd never heard of before. Igor Danchenko and Felix Sater. And I mean, no American could even keep track of all the names. And it was to convince us that Trump was a Russian asset. Meanwhile, Sheldon Adelson right. sitting right in the front row when Trump's giving a speech next to Netanyahu, telling him like, I'm giving you money to have a war with Iran. And no, and then like the press is like, we're not going to tell you who that guy is.
Yeah, and he funded. I think he funded. You know, I'm a big Las Vegas Raiders fan, and he I think he like was the big money behind the stadium out there too. And I remember seeing that name. I'm like, yeah. Dude, come on, yeah. Really? Like, I know that funding's always going to come from someone I probably don't care for, but it's just funny to see because the Davis family is one of the few football ownership families where like their only asset is football. It's not like Woody Johnson, yeah, you know, Kraft. Or Kraft, like all those guys. It's like, no, we just bought a football team when it was really cheap. So therefore we have this. But yeah, it's like seeing Adelson's name on there. It's just like, man, they get
Al Davis was always the bad guy, you know, historically in football. Like Woody Johnson. Yeah. I mean, how many Woody Johnson's just running around like paralyzing people's faces and, you know, Bob Kraft, completely sinister character, but you know, it's Al Davis, the big bad Al Davis with his dark shade. Have you been to the Venetian, by the way?
What's that?
Have you been to the Venetian, the Adelson Hotel?
I absolutely have.
It's actually kind of cool.
Oh, it's awesome. He's got good taste. I'm not going to say he does. The stadium's cool too. I mean, the stadium's great too. Hey, I mean, like I said, like when Elon bought Twitter or something, like, I don't care for Elon's car product. I don't care for a lot of the stuff that he does. I didn't, you know, there's some things I thought was okay, like not turning his Tesla factory into a ventilator factory for a month. I thought was a wise decision by him. But like the idea that, you know, when I was like, oh man, it would be really cool if he literally just concentrated on only Twitter. That would just be cool to me. Cause like, honestly, I don't have to use, I mean, yeah, I understand it's a really good big part. It's a weird thing when they want to control free speech, but Twitter was always owned by a billionaire, so who cares? That's not moving the needle to me.
You all would have been under the old regime. I think it was only a matter of time before you all were banned.
We were for a while it was like, you know, we were kind of just under that threshold of like not the big name, so it's okay. But for a while I got warnings. I mean, definitely shadow banned to the point where I was like, but then all of a sudden Elon took over and people start seeing what I post again. I'm not, that doesn't mean I'm an Elon fan, but I doesn't mean that you know, when he owns it, maybe personally for me it's better for the people who were actually right about things. And I do see people still getting censored under Elon's thing, like people that are saying good things. So it's not to say that he created this free speech platform, because you never will. It's a monetized platform, like that's never going to be free speech. I mean, it's always going to serve some sort of interest.
It's Gray Zone Radio. I'm your host, Max Blumenthal. You've been listening to my wide-ranging and spontaneous conversation with the podcast Rare Candy, about everything from Israel's protests to America's billionaire class to the Ukraine proxy war. Let's jump back in.
I mean, he did one thing that I will be forever grateful for. I would shake his hand for it. And it's the Twitter files. Like, it confirmed so much of what we'd been saying on Twitter.
That was incredible.
At the Gray Zone, which is that the intelligence agencies were controlling social media and censoring dissent. And it's you know, the Jim Jordan hearing in the House Committee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government. I don't, you know, obviously there's some cynicism behind it, some partisan politics guiding what Jordan is doing, but bringing Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger there to expose how in the intelligence agencies, the FBI, and the government agencies, down to, you know, the CDC, had been censoring factual content and blocking and banning people for simply disagreeing with the political establishment and the Biden administration, was as important as anything that was done during the Church Committee, because these are our digital commons. This is where the Twitter is as important as having a telephone in the 1950s at this point, or any social media platform.
Yeah, it's true.
Mm-hmm. And the enemy of humanity are these intelligence agencies. They're operating in a completely opaque, undemocratic fashion. So I think Elon contributed something to humanity there, almost made up for all the government money he took for SpaceX to blow up a bunch of fancy objects in the sky.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like, to me, hey man, if you want to laser focus on that, I have no problem with that. I know for a while he was like, am I going to do space or am I going to do cars? Am I going to do, it's like that. It's like, hey, why don't you just do social media? I have no problem with that. Like I know I can navigate through that. I know I can look at maybe a few posts that might hurt my feelings a little bit, you know, because I've used Twitter before 2016. So I would be able to do that and navigate throughout that world, because it was headed to a point where it was really feeling like just that true mass formation psychosis, but with as an enforceable law by social media companies. And I'm glad that we seem to be out of that in a way, you know.
Yeah. It was like, you look at the right side of your screen under the old regime and there'd just be like, fact check. It's like,
yeah, mm-hmm.
Something that is clearly true that upsets the establishment is mostly untrue. And right. Then, you know, all these nudge messages, like getting vaccinated improves your, like reduces your risk of car accidents by 13%. New study.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, exactly. So on that note, we got to revisit Ukraine. I know you've been talking about this a lot, but to be honest, I mean, you know, like you came on here, like I said, a year ago, laid out the whole plan. And to say, are you shocked? Was it worse than you thought? Or is it about as bad?
I actually, I thought it would, I got a few things wrong in the beginning. I thought it would end more quickly, right, with some kind of negotiations over the Donbass region, which is just almost entirely ethnic Russian at this point. Why would Ukraine need or want that? And the West came in and sabotaged the negotiations that were clearly going to take place in April. And so it led to a kind of a bloodbath, because Russia had sent in a large convoy, lots of infantry and cavalry towards the Kiev Oblast, which is at the center of Ukraine along the Dnipro River. And they didn't go, they had no intention of going into this major city and having like grinding urban combat. It would have been terrible for them. But the idea was that it would frighten Ukraine into coming to the table to see that much Russian armor and infantry there. And instead, what happened was Boris Johnson came in as Zelensky was preparing to go to the negotiating table and said, we're going to give you tons of weapons. We're going to give you tons of aid. We're going to basically fund your entire government, prop up your country, and we're going to make you an international hero. And, you know, you are an actor. Your ego is going to be stroked for the rest of time if you just continue this war. And the Ukrainian military is pretty good. And they had these Javelin missiles that could take out Russian armor that the U.S. provided. And so they went in and they fought. They lost a lot of men, but so did Russia. And the war just intensified. It continued to grind on. But I always knew that Ukraine would eventually run out of men, run out of material. And the West politically was not in a place where it could just have another endless proxy war. And that's where we are right now. Ukraine is just they're falling apart. Their military is falling apart before our eyes. And their experienced soldiers have all been killed, which is a huge tragedy. They could have all been alive. Right. And I think it will end up the way that it could have been if there had been negotiations in April 2022, which is that there will be some settlement over Crimea and the eastern part of the country.
Yeah, it's nuts, because it's just like every day, you know, and this is something like we defer to you on certain things like this. It's not something I'm well versed in or anything, but I do know one thing. When I see huge amounts of money, where you'll just see these like headlines, every celebrity jumping in, like I have a funny story to share a little bit later, but like every celebrity jumping in saying we need to mobilize Ukraine, help mobilize Ukraine. They need our help. But then you'll see like, well, Biden's offering X amount of billion of dollars to them, and Zelensky's like, that's it? Can we ramp that up a little? Like, it's like a Shark Tank negotiation almost. Like, and you know, and then it's like just seeing that amount of money in a time where just 2 years ago, people were losing their businesses. People were often losing their houses or just anything like that. Even people that were owning property weren't able to collect rent. So you just see an overall just collapse of people below all these elected officials really fighting each other. But we're supposed to just deeply hope that Ukraine gets the money, gets our money. We're supposed to deeply hope that they get that. It's just so sad.
Yeah. I mean, Ted Nugent, I don't know if you saw it, like a few days ago at the Trump rally. He was like, where's all my money going? I don't want my money going to some homosexual in Kiev. And I mean, okay. I mean, you didn't need to say it like that. And, Ted Nugent is a psycho, but the whole crowd is just going nuts. They're not down with it. And, 20 years ago, these people would have been like, let's get Bin Laden and Saddam. Right. Connected with thing. Now they're not into it anymore. Yeah. And that, to me, is a very positive development because those people saw the moral injury that was caused by, they felt it in middle America, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. They knew people whose legs were blown off, who had been driven to suicide, who had simply died. Better than a lot of people on the coast. Although like LA, California, the Chicano areas, they have like some of the highest enlistment rates. But the point is that they're not primed for these kinds of psychotic wars anymore. The US economy is not growing and producing the same kind of prosperity as it used to. So they're not feeling that. And so this is an education for many people in the US who never read Noam Chomsky and checked his footnotes on what the empire really is. And I think it's a turning point where you have these psychopaths around Joe Biden, these neoconservative, neoliberal ideologues who are guiding his foreign policy, Victoria Nuland, Jake Sullivan, and Anthony Blinken. And they want to actually use this proxy war as a springboard to wage war on China over Taiwan. And then you have like the Marines, officer level Marines have no interest in doing that. And you have veterans and you have Red America who are just, they're just not going to be on board for it at all. And the military is having its greatest recruitment crisis in history and openly says it. So where is this taking us? It's taking us to an internal crisis because the post-war US has thrived on its ability to constantly wage these very profitable wars without any consequence back home, politically or otherwise. I mean, we saw Vietnam, there were some serious political consequences. And so they got rid of the draft. Then Iraq, well, we just got rid of George W. Bush and continued being in Iraq.
Yeah.
Here, I think we've reached kind of a terminal point.
Yeah, the trust doesn't seem to be there. Like the trust doesn't, I mean, amongst the, people who basically Clockwork Orange themselves to have, liberal news networks on propping up Joe Biden. Yeah, those people, sadly, they're in my family, but they, those people, I don't ever want to talk politics with them again. I literally just want to talk like almost have like dementia style conversations with them where it's very it sounds rude, but it's just like, I don't ever want anything to get serious around them again, because I know that we just don't agree anymore. But for the overall, I mean, we're just not getting the benefits of like, wartime US, like where you'd get jobs created for it. You'd get all these certain things. Like we don't get those benefits of it. It's like, even after the Iraq war, whoever supported it, who didn't, there's a housing collapse a couple of years later after that. Like there's all these, like the benefits aren't there from this. And it's like, now you just watch celebrities, like it's like a celebrity war. It's the weirdest thing with Ukraine. Like just today this came out. I don't know if you saw this, Max, but it just came out that Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker, lends Star Wars voice to Ukrainian air raid app. So basically so essentially like Ukrainians can get their app on their phone and Mark Hamill, he doesn't warn them of airstrikes, which that would be insane, but like he doesn't warn them of airstrikes, but he says things like, don't be careless. Your overconfidence is your weakness. So he's basically telling them to keep their head on a swivel. Like this is, I'm sorry, it's like a Reddit war. Like it's weird. Like it's like, I'm not trying to downplay anything that's happened. I know that there's horrible violence that's happening. I don't sit here saying, come on, Russia, do this. Yeah, do this. But I know that like, for me, the whole Ukraine side of it and just my country, which has never really been honest with me in my life, but in the last 3 years has decided to ramp up the lying to a degree that is so jarring that it hurts to even talk about sometimes. When that happens, like, I tend to be like, man, let's just stop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mark Hamill. I mean, who has heard of Mark Hamill since Star Wars? You see all these washed up actors, like Orlando Bloom went to meet with Zelensky yesterday. It's like anyone who can meet with Zelensky, it's a career boost because he's one of the most famous actors in the world. And Mark Hamill was previously raising weapons for the Ukrainian military. He's raising money for weapons, which means, you know, he's raising money for U.S. weapons manufacturers. But the air raids are not really, you know, Ukrainian cities are not really experiencing air raids right now. Like, it's not like the Battle of Britain and people are huddled in the subways. Most of the fighting, if not all the fighting, is in the east. The fighting is over a series of population centers, and the Ukrainian military, well, first of all, the Ukrainian military police are running around cities hunting any male of military age, which could be between 16 and 50, and they wrap them up and bundle them into a van and drive them off, and then they send them to the front. And you've got little kids and old men being sent to the front because all the experienced fighters are being killed in cities like Bakhmut. And Zelensky keeps reinforcing his forces there, even though they have clearly lost. They're overwhelmed. They're in basically a cauldron, which means they're surrounded by Russian artillery units and they're running out of supply lines. And why is he doing it? It's because he needs to convince the West to send more money and send more weapons, that the battle is still being won. And the press is trying to crank it up, but you can see seeping out into the Washington Post and the New York Times headlines. Ukraine is running out of men, running out of munitions. They're starting to admit that it's falling apart. So why do we stand by if we care so much about Ukraine, and all these liberals have Ukrainian flags fluttering over their homes? If they care so much, then why do they continue to oppose negotiations that would end the slaughter? Because they're just being sent into a wood chipper of death.
Yeah, 100%. And it's like,
and it's because they're being lied to. Like you said, the people, you know, they're ingesting Blue Anon, MSNBC, Clockwork Orange style propaganda about victory, although victory is never defined. And I mean, if you want to get to the core of how delusional these people are, and we all have them in our lives, if we know liberals and we care about our liberal family members or friends, you know, you live in a big city, you're going to meet them. Ask them, do they think Joe Biden should run again, or how is Joe Biden doing?
Yeah.
And I mean, to a person, they will say, I think he's doing pretty well. And like, so, does he have dementia? Like, what are you talking about? That's like a right-wing talking point. Yeah, like,
right.
It's staring you right in the face. The president is like late stage Reagan or worse. He's just babbling, drooling. You know, there was a mass shooting yesterday and he was talking about giving chocolate out to kids.
Yeah.
The press conference.
Shaking hands of people that aren't
Hold on. Let him cook.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the right has this, like, the right understands that there's a deep state, but everyone, like the liberals, Blue Anon, they think Biden's in charge. Like he's actually like calling the shots.
Yeah, and liberals think the deep state is like their garbage man that voted for Trump too. That's like the sad part about it all, is like, it's like you guys have such like low aspirations for what, like, you know, behind the scenes actually is. Like they think it's like this network of like they actually, like, it's weird, like they hate QAnon, but they think QAnon's actually real. Like they think Trump actually like sends signals to like the people down, you know, like they send Trump sends these like weird like brainwave signals, and like all these like random guys with shovels in their hands and high visibility vests on just look up in the sky and are going like, okay, yeah, Trump, I got it. We'll do that. We'll do another terrible event or something. Like, and it's just delusion. I mean, it's what happens when you're locked in your house for a couple of years and all you watched was the news and one form of news. Therefore, like those people, like you thought you're only alive because you did that. So therefore anything they say after that.
Yeah. Well, they also think everything's QAnon. Like this guy thinks that America blew up the pipeline. That's QAnon, you know?
Yeah. Good point.
Which is, I know that's old news, but I wanted to talk, I never talked to you about that. The pipeline thing that seemed to kind of get glossed over, even though it was big news. Like that seems crazy to me. Like what's going on
there? Yeah. I mean, that's the Nord Stream pipeline sabotage has been great for America's elite. It's been great for U.S. geopolitical power. And so that was another reason that the U.S. wanted to keep this war going, or at least the people around Biden, but also the people around Ted Cruz in Texas, the LNG people, the domestic oil and gas producers. Because think about it from their point of view. All right, you're funding Germany's military through NATO and helping them defray the costs of their social democracy. We have none here. And at the same time, they're building this pipeline with Russia, where Russia's going to supply cheap natural gas to them to heat their homes. And they're not buying your liquid natural gas from Texas, which provides all the jobs there. Everyone's working hard there, capping the wells, building their facilities. Germany should buy from us. Yeah. And then think about it from the point of view of like a Washington neocon. Russia is one of the most resource-rich countries on the planet. Germany has some of the most advanced technical know-how and industry on the planet. And the two of them are getting together, connecting physically through a pipeline that will also produce political ties, which will take Germany further away from the U.S. orbit and bring technological know-how together with rich natural resources, and it will weaken you. It's like Zbigniew Brzezinski's grand chessboard, which really explains the overarching theory and strategy of American empire. That's your nightmare, is Germany and Russia get together, and then Russia's getting together with China. So you're losing the whole Eurasian continent. So you got to blow up that pipeline, and you have perfect cover to do so with this war. And so what do you blow it up, and then you blame Russia for blowing up its own pipeline.
Yeah. And was that Seymour Hersh that eventually, like, I don't know if he was the first guy to say it, but it seems like that's who got everybody riled up about suggesting that it happened. I mean, he kind of caught a lot of flack for that.
Yeah. Well, it's like the Beltway press, the U.S. press is so disciplined that they will never apply pressure or scrutiny on the worst act of industrial sabotage in history, which was also a huge environmental catastrophe. All this methane gas went up into the atmosphere, and all the environmental groups were like, well, let's look the other way because we're totally controlled and funded by Mike Bloomberg. And, so there wasn't any pressure on the administration after this took place. Then Seymour Hersh, the most famous investigative journalist alive, who exposed everything from the My Lai massacre to the Abu Ghraib torture scandal, comes forward with a Substack article with a well-placed source explaining how this operation took place, how it was authorized by the CIA and ultimately by Biden, and it was carried out by divers trained in Panama City, Florida, and it took place under the cover of the BALTOPS U.S. naval exercises in the Baltic Sea. It all kind of fit with how I understood it could have taken place. And he may have gotten, there may have been some things that he didn't get right, but he basically explained what everyone knew to be true. And it forced a response. And the response was hilarious. First, the New York Times publishes a piece based on controlled leaks provided by the administration or U.S. intelligence, claiming that a pro-Ukrainian group had actually done it, not the U.S., but a pro-Ukrainian group. So they dropped the lie about Russia doing it, and they said a pro-Ukrainian group, some private operators.
Private operators.
And they finally mentioned Seymour Hersh's article in the New York Times in the 23rd paragraph as the means of dismissing it. Then Germany starts its own operation, its own PSYOP. And this is after German Chancellor Olaf Scholz had just returned from Washington. They say that a pro-Ukrainian group of private Ukrainians in a pleasure yacht called the Andromeda carried explosives across the Polish border by land to Germany, then disembarked from Rostock, Germany, to the Baltic Sea in a literal pleasure yacht, and then dove to the deepest part somehow of the Nord Stream pipelines and attached massive amounts of explosives that were capable of blasting through rebar and concrete reinforcements. And then they were able to come up without massive oxygen tanks or a decompression chamber to this pleasure yacht and escape in one of the most heavily surveilled parts of the world. And also somehow they knew where the pipelines were.
Yeah, that's my thing. Well, like it's in the, it's off the grid damn near. Like if you were just to be searching, like you're like, I don't know where this is. Like the technology, I mean, but again, the way people believe that is these are people that think like the Kennedy assassination, just Lee Harvey Oswald, one guy. Yeah. Look how he got it done. And great, insane thing how that got done. Like, it's like all the, we're always taught that it's just this one like Marvel villain that takes out this one thing. It's never us. Wouldn't be us. You know, even though that's often the twist, even in the Marvel movie, is it actually
it went through
is.
His head.
Yeah.
His head went back and to the right. And then it turned around and took a U-turn and went into John Connolly's chest.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
And I don't know if you've ever been to Dealey Plaza.
I haven't.
You got to go. Okay, so you can go to the Texas Book Depository, but then they fence off the area where Oswald shot from and they recreate like all the books there, which is kind of cool. But you can kind of get a sense of the shot. And the car's coming around a turn, but it has a chance to speed up a little bit. It's an impossible shot. And he had ordered what's like an Italian model, like a single shot, like field rifle that he ordered by mail. It wasn't like a sniper rifle. So,
yeah,
I mean, if he did it, it was the luckiest shot ever. And if these divers in a pleasure yacht pulled that off, like they have the biggest lungs on earth.
Exactly. And it's like, you know, we as Americans, like, you know, while that's happening, we have the East Palestine, which, why is it East Palestine? It's just such a town in Ohio. Yeah. It's so
they
insane.
Call it Palestine there.
Oh, is it? Okay. And so it's like they have the, you know, the train derails, a bunch of what we think are hazardous chemicals are leaking. Then the response to that is to blow that up and just put a mushroom cloud over a whole city. Very Dom DeLillo white noise. And then you have the... you know, our mutual friend Jeremy Lafredo just went out there. I was like, "You're insane," but go ahead. You know, like you just go straight to the chemi-. I'd be like, I told him to mask up, like jokingly, but kind of, you know. And like, I was like, "Go check it out." Like, hey man, wear a mask, man. Like, hey, be careful. And so he goes out there, and like even he's a little like confused. He's like, "Yeah, it like seems really bad, but like the people cleaning stuff up aren't wearing any protective gear." And, you know, you see stuff, some of the ecosystem belly up in the like frogs and things like that belly up. And like some of this stuff happens, but it's like we're almost just like conditioned to stuff like blowing up and lighting on fire. I live in California and it's like earthquakes and stuff lighting on fires. We're just like, hey, that's just going to happen. I hate to break it to you. And it's like, but this is like Union Pacific Railroad, right? I mean, it's like this is crazy. These type of things, like it's just everything's blowing up.
Yeah.
I mean, I would just recommend everyone watch Jeremy's report.
Yeah.
It was one of the only independent reports that kind of was like a standalone documentary from East Palestine, where he would just go up in the gas station or in repair shops and interview people about what was happening. And they would provide a really detailed account of how everything that was done by Union Pacific was Norfolk Southern was like absolutely the wrong thing to do, and that they were being told everything was fine, just move on. And there was this horrible smell in the air that was burning their lungs, and they don't know how that will play out in the long run for their health, for the sustainability of East Palestine as a town. Many of them are talking about having to move. And who is telling them everything was fine? It was an environmental testing group that was literally a front for Norfolk Southern that was being sponsored by the company responsible for this spill, that had also been implicated or sued by the Department of Justice for producing phony findings in one of the worst toxic spills in U.S. history. Jeremy also documented private police who were sponsored by Norfolk Southern trying to keep people away from certain areas. And then, you know, he went to the streams like every other reporter did and just showed hundreds and hundreds of dead frogs and fish and wildlife. I mean, it was chilling.
Yeah.
Definitely. But it took place in a small town that's sort of a sacrifice zone. And we have sacrifice zones across America. So it was ignored initially. The media wasn't going out there. The administration didn't want to talk about it. Democrats in Congress didn't want to talk about it. And it really like came down to independent media, local authorities. And then, you know, the Trump element started seizing on it because it made the Biden administration look completely neglectful. Why? Because where was Biden?
Yeah, he wouldn't go.
Kiev. He was meeting Zelensky and having a fake air raid. Like, remember when he came out with Zelensky and they're holding hands?
Yeah.
And they put on an air raid siren, even though there was no air raid. There were no bombing taking place of Kiev. It was to dramatize the situation, whereas Americans were horrified about what's happening at home. So it perfectly crystallized what we're living through right now, where you have an administration that clearly cares more about their Ukrainian proxy than they do about the people they're supposed to represent.
This was another episode of Gray Zone Radio for Pacifica. I'm your host, Max Blumenthal, and the editor of thegrayzone.com. To see more of our work and sign up for our newsletter, visit thegrayzone.com. That's GRAYzone.com. This episode was produced by Christopher Weaver.
Bicycle. Support comes from Ciclovia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets since 2010. Join us for the next Ciclovia Sunday, Mid-City meets Pico Union, on April 16th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. All forms of people-powered transport welcome. Walking, running, biking, skating, skateboarding, scooting, strolling, plus pedicab rides available on the route. Enjoy these L.A. streets as a park for the day, generating 4 miles of smiles. For more details, visit ciclavia.org, that's ciclavia.org, and your favorite community radio station, kpfk.org. I want to ride
my bicycle. Hey, Scott Horton here to let you know that Anti-War Radio is moving to Thursday afternoons at 2:30. For a dozen years here on KPFK, I've brought you the best experts, journalists, and activists working to end the American empire. For most of that time on Sunday mornings. But again, starting next week, Anti-War Radio will air every Thursday at 2:30 Pacific Time. In the meantime, check out the archives. More than 5,800 interviews going back to 2003 at scotthorton.org. Talk to you Thursday at 2:30.
Support comes from one of the greatest icons of Brazilian music and four-time Latin Grammy winner, Jovan, presenting a brand new show at the Wiltern on May 7th, 2023. Jovan will perform with his full band, featuring songs from his 25th studio album, D, as well as major hits from his 45-year career. Tickets are available now at LiveNation.com. Jovan, live at the Wiltern, Sunday, May 7th, 2023. For more information, go to kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Denise Akbari, a journalism student and reporter for KPFK's Cal State LA Community News Hour. I was thrilled and beyond honored to contribute my story without love or money, which is part of the Race, Class, and Gender in American Journalism Class project, Herb But Hopeful, and my story, Buried Dreams, produced for the UT Community News Class to the show. KPFK has helped me reach a bigger audience by making my reporting accessible through a different medium. Cal State LA Community News Hour has also helped me learn how to record and produce audio stories, which are real-world experiences. This is a great opportunity. Thanks so much to KPFK's staff and volunteers for allowing me to be part of this.
KPFK, your community radio station.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you've been listening to Pacifica and KPFK for years, even decades, and you appreciate how important KPFK is in your life. If you're a forward-thinking donor who wants future generations to benefit from KPFK's independent journalism and unhindered creativity, then join KPFK's Legacy Circle and include KPFK in your will or living trust. For details, visit our website at KPFK. For details, visit our website at kpfk.org, and thank you for considering KPFK in your future gift-giving plans.